चायन विष्णुपाद परमहंस सपरिवार के चार अष्टस्थ श्री श्रीमती स्वामी श्रील भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर की ग्रंथराज श्रीमद्भागवतम की गौर प्रेमानंदी और ग्लोरी टू द सम ऑफ द डिवोटीज और ग्लोरी टू द सम ऑफ द डिवोटीज और ग्लोरी टू द सम ऑफ द डिवोटीज और ग्लोरी टू द लोटस फीट ऑफ श्री गुरु एंड श्री गौरांगा ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायण नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जायं मुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेषु पुत्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवती उत्तमा श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी. Reading from Canto 10, Chapter 15, Verse 14. Thank you so much. Thank you, my Lord. All right. Believe your own text. Yeah, 13. Chakura pancha chakraha Bharadvajam shabarhinah Anurotisma sattvanam Vita vadhyagra simhayoho Chakura krancha chakrava Bharadvajam shabarhinah Anurati sma sattvanam Vita vadhyagra simhayoho Chakura kancha chakrava Bharadvajam shabarhinah Anurati sma sattvanam Bhita vadvyagra simhayoho. Check, you want to try? Meter? No problem, we can do it next time. Mataji? Nay? Okay. Chakura krancha chakrava bharadvajancha. The chakura, krancha, chakrava, and bharadvaja birds. Okay, let's do one more. The chakura, krancha, chakravaha, and bharadvaja birds. Barhinaha, the peacocks. Anuroti sma, he would call out in imitation of. Satvanam, together with the other creatures. Bhitavat, acting as if afraid. Vyagra simhayoho, of the tigers and lions. Translation: sometimes he would cry out in imitation of birds, such as the chakoras, crunches, chakravas, bharadvajas, and peacocks. And sometimes he would run away with the smaller animals in mock fear of lions and tigers. Purport by Srila Prabhupada's disciples. Kijai. The word bhitavat, as if afraid, indicates that Lord Krishna played just like an ordinary boy and ran with the smaller forest creatures in mock fear of the lions and tigers. Actually, in Vrindavan, the abode of the Lord, the lions and tigers are not violent, and thus there is no reason to fear them. Om Agyanatitimirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Namo Mahavadanyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gauratvishe Namaha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Shute Devi Panamami Hari Priye Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bevacha Patitanam Pavnebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo 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 Hare Hare One more time, together this time. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Ramo, Ramo Ramo, Hare Hare Good morning, welcome to the Srimad Bhagavatam class. Before I begin, I would like to look at all the devotees and ask for your blessings. That ashirvad, that I can speak nicely on this very elevated subject matter that we've been discussing for a few days. So this verse here, it continues the description of Krishna's pastimes in the forest of Vrindavan. So just a little update for Bhakta Jack, who hasn't been here in a few days. We're basically discussing how Krishna plays in the forest of Vrindavan with his coward boyfriends. So we've heard a description of how he enters the forest, and now we're hearing a description of some of the games that they play. So here it's specifically describing how they imitate the sound of birds. Just like when we were kids, you know, a police siren goes by and all they're like, wow, wow, you know, like that kind of stuff. But you know, the thing is, we had police sirens and fire hydrants to play with, but the forest of Vrindavan is very rich with all kinds of natural beauty. So there's exotic birds just flying around, making beautiful sounds, and Krishna and his coward boyfriends will run around and imitate the sounds of these birds. In another place, actually, it also says that they were imitating the frogs. So just like the frogs leap from one frog to another, then Krishna and his coward boyfriends would like leap around like frogs and walk like peacocks, you know, like their heads bobbing back and forth. But here it's saying that they were imitating the sounds of birds, exotic birds like chakravas and peacocks. And when he would hear the roar of lions and tigers, then Krishna, pretending to be afraid, would run away. And Srila Jiva Goswami makes a nice point that actually he was doing it also to instill fear into some of the younger boys, just to kind of freak them out a little bit, you know. So these were some of the games that Krishna and his coward boyfriends would play in the forest of Vrindavan. And this is actually something very interesting and very exalted, because if you look at the other religious traditions of the world, then they go only as far as to describe certain qualities of God, right? That God is great, God is the controller, God is the judge. But there's not a single religious tradition on earth that can actually tell you what God does during the day, right? If they tell, at least their scriptures can tell you. Like, you can ask a Christian, like, hey, what does God do? He's created the earth. What does he do all day? Well, I think he sits on a throne and judges people. I don't know. I think he, like, that was a good time. Well, how does he have a good time? You know what I'm saying? No one knows, actually, because their scriptures are completely silent on the personal life of God, the inner workings. Some devotees put it like this: most religious traditions are only concerned with the office of God, God's position as the controller, the judge, the creator, the source of everything. And we get that in the Bhagavad Gita, right? Krishna says in multiple places in the Gita how he is everything. He is and my favorite verse in the Gita, where Krishna says that, you know, this entire universe rests on me like pearls rest on a string. In other words, just like you see pearls resting on a string, just like our kanti malas, but you don't see the thread underneath the kanti mala, right? You don't see the thread. Anybody sees the thread? I don't see the thread. Nobody sees the thread, right? In the same way, this world is resting on the Lord, just like pearls rest on a string. In other words, he's the foundation, but nobody sees that. But one who knows how to make a kanti mala, here, no, it's not that they're just stuck together, you know, by glue or by gravitational force, right? If you have a little bit of intelligence, you understand that, just like when I was a kid, I literally thought there was a man inside my television box. And I would turn him on and he would start speaking to me. I mean, I was like 2-3 years old, you know. But as you grow up, you realize there's no man inside the TV. In the same way, when you grow up, you realize there's a string underneath the kanti mala. And when you become very advanced and mature, you realize there's God underneath the material reality. Right? What a beautiful analogy. It's this pearls rest on a string. You know, the whole world rests upon me. So in this way, Krishna explains in the Gita in great detail how he's the basis of reality. Right? This is the office of God. This is the function he plays in regards to us. Right? This is how usually we understand God according to our reality. So we live in this world, so we must think, okay, well, this world must come from somewhere. So it must come from a great place because it's a great world. I couldn't have produced it. So it must have come from God. So in that way, we see God relative to our reality. But this is God, not relative to our reality, but in His reality. You see the difference? This is His reality. It's not like Krishna plays with his kind of boyfriends because we play with kids here, therefore Krishna plays with his friends in the spiritual world. No, he plays with his friends in the spiritual world, therefore us playing here makes sense. The material world is a very beautiful reflection of the spiritual reality. The principles that work there also work here, right? Why is it that in this world, when you give a girl a flower, she smiles? Why is it that in this world, when a mother sees her little baby crying for help, she runs and picks him up and hugs him? You know, why is it that in this world, you know, when you sit down with a dear friend and you crack some jokes, right, you feel the sense of happiness? Isn't it, Josh? You and I do this all the time. Why does it bring happiness? Why are these things so universal? You go anywhere in the world, Mexicans, Colombians, Chinese people, the Russians, maybe not the Japanese so much, they don't have much of a sense of humor. But practically anywhere in the world, people sit together and laugh and share a meal and they have a good time. Why does that work? It's an eternal spiritual principle. When young boys get together, crack jokes and share a meal, pleasure is produced. Because that's what happens in the spiritual world. Krishna gets together with his cow boyfriends. He gets together with the other animals. He gets together with his mother. He gets together with his girlfriends. And through his interactions, he's showing us what are the core fundamental principles of interaction that will produce an experience of relationship. And that's the same thing that produces relationship here in this world. You know, a sense of relationship in this world. And you can see when there's rupture in a relationship, right? Like say there's a rupture between a mother and a son, or a husband and a wife, or a brother and a brother. It's because one of them is not acting according to these universal principles of what facilitates relationship. You see what I'm saying? As soon as people start breaking the principles of relationships that come from the spiritual world, things don't work anymore. So Krishna is showing us, through his interactions with his coward boyfriends, what are the eternal principles of relationships. And there's two very beautiful reasons he does that, actually. Why do we even know that these pastimes exist? Right? Why are we even aware of these pastimes in the material world? You know? Because Krishna says in the Gita, Puritranayam sadhunam vinashaya chadushkritam dharma samsthapanarthaya sambhavami yuge yuge. So there's a very famous verse from the Bhagavad Gita. You have a Gita. You always have a Gita with you, right? Let's read this translation. And there's a very beautiful point that's brought up by our acharyas. So Krishna explains in the fourth chapter why he appears in the material world. And this is a famous verse. Everyone's heard this many times. He says, to deliver the pious and to annihilate the miscreants, as well as to reestablish the principles of religion, I myself appear millennium after millennium. To deliver the pious, to annihilate the miscreants, as in to kill demons. To deliver the pious actually means, in this context, to bring the devotees from the material world to the spiritual world. Those devotees who have come to a certain level of practice in their spiritual life, and now they actually want to cross over. They want to go to the other world. They want to go to the kingdom of God. And for them, Krishna's pastimes are the boat. We'll just hear about that in a second. And to reestablish the principles of religion. And the religion that we're talking about here is not just, you could say, mundane religion or materialistic religion. It actually refers to prema dharma, the religion of love. So Krishna's pastimes are like a beautiful light that shine in the material world and show us what is real life all about. What is reality all about? And this is so important to hear about and to understand, because if there isn't something higher in this world to attract us, then we'll always feel that the relationships of this world are the most important. You follow? Unless you realize that there is a more beautiful relationship between Krishna and the gopis than anything you can experience with girls in this world, you will never give up mundane taste for like materialistic relationship. It's not possible. You can only give up something lower when there is something higher, but that something higher has to become visible to us. That's why Krishna comes and performs these pastimes and makes sure that people know about them. Because only when you know that such a thing exists can you let go of the desire to enjoy materialistic relationships in this world. You follow what I'm saying? Only when you have the money to buy a nice car will you get rid of your old crappy car. You know, it's just an internal principle. Something higher has to be present for something lower to go away. I'll read you, now I want to just read briefly a few lines from the commentary of Sri Baldeva Debhushan on this verse, because it's very nice and it really supports the theme of our class today, which is why does Krishna perform his pastimes in the material world. So he says here, so the first doubt that Baldeva Debhushan raises is that, okay, you come to destroy the demons and to establish religion, but even a pious king can do that. And that's true, right? A great king like Maharaj Yudhishthira or King Bharat or King Rishabdev, these are all kings from the Bhagavatam, they're fully capable of establishing the principles of religion, right? So why exactly are you coming? So here's Sri Baldev paraphrasing the thoughts of Krishna. He says, my devotees are absorbed in relishing my form and qualities. They long to see my form and thus suffer from not seeing my form. For anybody who's been practicing for a few years, try going a few days without seeing the deity or taking part in a kirtan. I think you can relate. We have to sometimes visit our family members. And I know for me, after like, I love my mom, you know, but after like 2 days, I'm like, man, I really want to go take darshan. I mean, I'm lucky, I'm from Jaipur. So when I go see my parents, I go and take darshan of Govindaji almost every day in the evenings. And it's like amazing for me. It's like spend the whole day, like I never get to take darshan. I don't get to hear devotees chanting. But then in the evenings I go and I see the Lord's deity form and I feel so sheltered. Actually, I feel like I'm home, you know. And this is the experience of anybody who's been practicing for some time, that after you leave the association of devotees, even for a short while, you start to miss it, isn't it? Isn't it? You start to feel like, man, I haven't been in a kirtan in like 2, haven't seen a deity, haven't like done anything really Krishna conscious. I mean, yeah, I'm chanting my rounds, I'm reading, but there's something about the form of the Lord in bhakti that really kind of melts the heart, in a sense, and triggers some emotional feelings, you know? So it's so nice what Sri Baldev was saying, that the devotees suffer from not seeing my form. In order to deliver them from this suffering, by showing my attractive forms directly, I appear. And then he says, I also appear to spread dharma, pure bhakti yoga, with meditation on me, and deity worship only to me, and Vedic dharma as well, which cannot be spread by anyone other than me. In other words, what Krishna is saying is that he comes to the material world, he displays his beautiful pastimes of playing with his friends and, you know, being chastised by his mother and stealing butter and all these activities, so that we can be attracted to him. It's simple. That's the whole principle of bhakti yoga. And there's another very nice verse in the Bhagavatam that I'd like to just share on this occasion. This is from the 12th canto. And here's another, this is just in support of what we just read from Sri Baldeva Debhushanam. And the verse says, it's 12th canto, chapter 4, verse 40. It says, for a person who is suffering in the fire of countless miseries and who desires to cross the insurmountable ocean of material existence. That's a very beautiful point. The first half of the verse says, one who is suffering in the fire of countless miseries. See, in the material world, it's very easy to forget how we have a stockpile of karma that's slowly unfolding in our life. You know what I'm saying? Of course, as devotees, we don't have to deal with karma, but we still have to deal with the reactions to our tendency to want to enjoy this world. Okay, we have a tendency to want to enjoy this world, and Krishna wants to root this out of our hearts. And sometimes, the only way, and hearing helps, when you hear philosophy, it really helps root out some of that tendency, but sometimes even that's not enough, you know? Sometimes even if I tell you, like, hey, smoking's bad, right? Sometimes it's hard to give it up. So how will this tendency go away? One has to suffer. You know, one has to... I know a friend of mine who suffered from shoplifting for years, you know, and then one day he was arrested and thrown in jail. He's from a really good family. He was just doing it for like fun, you know, but that's what it took. It took going to jail, you know, being in a lockup, getting a record before he could realize this is bad. I got to stop doing this, you know. So it's the same thing with us. We have a tendency to want to enjoy this world. So Krishna will, you know, sometimes allow us to experience some suffering in this material world, just so that tendency can disappear from the core of our heart, right? So, and an intelligent person, Prabhupada writes in the introduction to Gita, is one who realizes, I'm suffering and I don't want to suffer. This is the difference between a spiritualist and a materialist. A materialist suffers and thinks, you know what, I'm only suffering right now because I don't have the perfect combination of matter. My girlfriend's not pretty enough, my apartment's not big enough, my car is not fast enough, my job doesn't have enough, you know, like power in it. So materialist things, once I fix all of this, I'll be happy. Isn't it? That's how materialistic people think. They think, they look at all that they have, and they think, I'm not happy right now because I don't have this, I don't have the job fulfillment I'm looking for, I don't really have the kind of strong physical body that I'm looking for, my kids are really kind of annoying. Okay, so let me change everything, you know? Let me get a new wife, let me go work out, let me go on a keto diet, this is the new thing, keto diets, let me get a keto diet. And let me go get a, you know, let me take an online course, a weekend MBA, and then I'll get that consulting job. Yeah, I'll be doing well for myself. I'll make money. I'll be happy, you know. But actually, a devotee understands that there's no way to solve my material suffering by just changing the shape of matter that surrounds me. You know what I'm saying? That's not going to solve my problems. Like, I'll have more to deal with, actually. I'll have the same problems, but in a different scenario. You know, I haven't evolved in terms of my consciousness. One thing Jajana Prabhu told me very early on in my Krishna consciousness, I was just coming around and I had this opportunity to move to DC and work for this like bank. It was a dream job actually, because it was a non-profit bank and they used to give loans to poor people to help them start businesses. And I was really into stuff like that, like social welfare, charity, you know, supporting the poor, empowering the poor. It was like a dream job. And these people really liked me, so I had this opportunity to potentially move to DC and work. And I was just talking to Jai Jagannath, and I was like, yeah, you know, it's probably an ISKCON temple in DC, right? I could go there sometimes. But you see, somehow Krishna made him say something that changed the rest of my life. He said to me, you know, you can go from here to DC, or to San Francisco, or to London, because I'd also gotten into a master's program at the University of London. So it was either that, or I was going to get this job in DC. So I was like really contemplating what to do. And Jajana said to me, he said, you know, but if you don't have a change in consciousness, the problems you're trying to run away from here will go with you there. And that's a very profound statement. Because you see, we're running away from things because there's something within us that hasn't evolved. And until that evolves, you know, we'll go to that new destination and that those same things will come up again. You know, sometimes people have a hard time in one particular community because the relationships aren't working out so well. So then they leave, going someplace else, but then they find that actually they're having similar issues with people here. You know, so, and they haven't figured, actually it's not them. Maybe it's partly them. I don't want to put all the blame on. But you know, sometimes it's also us. But we're not always so in tuned with that. We usually like to blame the environment. So we usually like to just change the environment. So anyway, so my original point was that a materialistic person suffers because he just tries to change his environment without changing his consciousness. But a devotee, on the other hand, realizes that actually the true solution to my suffering is not just changing the environment, it's to evolve my consciousness. So that's what this verse says. For a person who's suffering in the fire of countless miseries and who desires to cross the insurmountable ocean of material existence. So then the devotee realizes, you know what? This is the nature of material reality. What are the three sufferings that always afflict the conditioned soul? One of them. What does that mean? So, the first type of suffering that makes, you know, suffering coming from one's own body and mind, adhyatmic klesh. Somebody else? Alex, Adam? What is that in Sanskrit? I think David refers to suffering caused by nature. Adhibhautik. Yeah. Okay, there we go. Now you have the answer. Yeah, suffering caused by natural calamities. So, you know, storms, Today's going to be really hot, by the way. For me, that's suffering because I like cold weather. You know, so suffering caused by nature, suffering caused by our neighbors, sometimes by our you know, near and dear ones. Usually it's the near and dear ones because they do the most damage. Suffering caused by, you know, people you're very close to. And suffering caused by our own body and mind. People get sick. People have health issues. Sometimes people are depressed. I meet a lot of people who are just like, you know, like blue. They're just like, I'm just sad. I'm just depressed. I'm like, you know, everything is dark. And so their own mind is the cause of so much suffering. So an intelligent person sees, wow, there's a lot of suffering in this world. You know, there's a lot of suffering in this world. People I trust can't be trusted. You know, things that I was hoping would work out can't work out. It's hard to get that awareness when you're young. When you're 19, the whole world is like, that's going to be great. Whatever happens, it's going to work out, you know. But ask an older person, ask somebody in their 40s and 50s, and they'll tell you with experience, you know what, it's not as rosy as you think. I mean, things will work out, but the world is a place of suffering. It's designed to make you suffer. If you have good karma, you might hide from that for a while, but ultimately, the suffering is designed to help you get this desire. Okay, let me cross. Let me go to a world where there isn't suffering. So then he says, and who desires to cross the insurmountable ocean of material existence, there is no suitable boat. So when you want to cross, you need a medium, you need a method to go to the other side. And it's very mystical because the other side is something we have never seen or experienced. It's something we've only heard about. Think about that for a second. The spiritual reality is actually, it sounds very close because we're reading about it all the time, but it's something at least I have never experienced. I don't know if the spiritual world exists or not. I mean, I have faith that it does because I read it in the scriptures and I believe in God. You know what I'm saying? But I haven't physically been there and seen it. I've heard from the lips of Srila Prabhupada that it exists. So that's how we have our conviction. Okay, the great souls have said it. The great souls have seen it. They've said it, so we accept. You know, but we for ourselves haven't yet crossed over. So it says, the verse says, there is no suitable boat except that of cultivating devotion. So I think everyone knew that was coming, right? But devotion for what? To the transcendental taste for the narrations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's pastimes. In other words, we have to cultivate. Cultivation means it's something you do on a regular basis to get better at, right? Like, maybe I shouldn't mention where we're going this morning, but Adam and I are going to go someplace today we've never been to before. And eventually, if we keep going there, we're going to get really good at going, you know, doing what we do at this place. You know, so that's what it means to cultivate something. Like a photographer, right? Maybe when you first start out, it's kind of like you're taking a picture of the house, but the house is all the way over here, and you get the top of someone's head. You know, it's like, that's not so great. You know, so you cultivate, you keep doing it, you keep doing it, you read books about it, you look at other good photographers. That's how bhakti works. You read the books, you look at other great examples of like spiritualists really made it, who crossed over, you know, like great souls in the past, you know, the Acharyas, Srila Prabhupada, Narottam Das Thakur, Sri Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, Bhava Mangal Thakur. You read about them, you know, you read their works, and this way you cultivate your own expertise at performing devotional service, and in that way you cultivate a taste for the narrations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's pastimes. In other words, you hear these things. There's no other way to cultivate a taste for something unless doing it, right? How will you become a better photographer without taking pictures? Right? It doesn't work like that. So the Bhagavatam is saying, cultivate a taste for hearing the narrations of the Supreme Lord's pastimes. And in that way, you will find yourself in a boat that helps you cross beyond this ocean of material suffering. Yesterday, Alex Puri was sharing with me how our classes have been so kind of receke a little bit. You know, we're talking about the mood and the emotions of the Cowherd Boys and the activities of Vrindavan. So actually, I owe this morning's class to him, because when he made that, and then he said, but you know, it hasn't been so much like practical points. It's more like the emotions and the feelings. So I was like, yeah, it's true. And you know, when I was thinking about this word practical, right? And that's kind of what inspired my class this morning, because what is practical? Practical means how we do things in this world, right? How we distribute, you know, like when we go out and do physical things, how we pay the bills, how we distribute the books, how we clean the temple, how we deal in various situations, right? The practical things relating to life. And I was really thinking about it. I was like, but you know, those physical actions have to be accompanied with a certain mental culture. Right? If we just do physical, practical actions, but the mental culture of why am I doing this is not actually in place, then it's actually very impractical. You know, we're just moving our hands and our feet. We're not really going anywhere. You know what I'm saying? So actually, I was thinking about how actually hearing about Krishna's pastimes, at least for some time in the day, in the morning, you know, can give us that kind of mental culture. It goes off every day, right around 8:08. I wonder whose it is. Okay. So anyways, so it gives us a mental foundation for all the physical activities that we engage in during the day, so that those activities combined with our hearing of Krishna's pastimes can actually situate us nicely in the boat that will help us cross beyond the material world. And that's a very beautiful process, actually. And a devotee is interested in that. A devotee is interested in crossing over, isn't it? That's why we came to Krishna consciousness. We found the material world to not be such a great place, so we came here. But then sometimes when we come to Krishna consciousness, maybe we forget that actually, I mean, I should be interested in cultivating my onward journey, you know. So therefore, hearing these pastimes, understanding them, you know, like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, one who knows the transcendental nature of my birth and activities never takes birth again. So if we were interested in finding a solution to suffering, then this is the boat that's given by our tradition. You know, this boat of Krishna's. The what is the boat? The devotion to the taste for the narrations of Supreme Lord's pastimes. In other words, one has devotion for, one has a hankering to have a taste for hearing these pastimes. And one cultivates that. So, I thought, everything I spoke, wow, it's interesting. I had all these notes about things I wanted to talk about, and I didn't really cover most of these things. Okay. All right, let's just jump forward a little bit. So, in this verse, we see here that Krishna runs away in mock fear from the lions and tigers in order to create some excitement amongst his coward boyfriends. So I was thinking about two other pastimes in the Bhagavatam when Krishna pretends in order to elicit a response from those around him for some other purpose, actually. And two very prominent pastimes in the 10th canto where Krishna pretends in order for something else to take place is the first pastime is when he runs away from Jarasandha. Right? Jarasandha was a great king who attacked Dwarka 18 times. And when he attacked Dwarka the 19th time, in the middle of the battlefield, Krishna runs away. And that's why it gets the name Ranchor, one who runs away from the battlefield. So Prabhupada explains actually why Krishna does that. So let's hear. I know hearing sometimes can be a little tough, but I'll read slowly, and I hope I have your full attention. So let's hear why it is that Krishna runs away from Jarasandha. If you want to follow along, it's in the Krishna book. You can pull it up on your phones, might make it a little bit easier. I mean, I thought about just like memorizing what Prabhupada wrote and then speaking about it, but it's kind of nice to just hear Prabhupada's words directly, actually. Okay. So it's the, if anybody wants to pull up, it's the 52nd chapter of the Krishna book, and we'll read beginning from the paragraph that says, Lord Sri Krishna wanted, it's I think the third paragraph, yeah. Okay, 52nd, yeah. We'll give everyone 5 seconds to pull it up. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. You have it, Jack? Okay, great. So, Lord Sri Krishna wanted to save Mathura from the 18th attack of the great military divisions of King Jarasandha. To prevent further killing of soldiers and to attend to other important business, Lord Krishna left the battlefield without fighting. Actually, he was not at all afraid, but he pretended to be an ordinary human being, frightened by the immense quantity of soldiers and resources of Jarasandha. By the way, just in this point, I have an uncle who is a flaming atheist. And when he found out that I was a devotee of Krishna, he started chastising me. He said, how can you worship a king who couldn't even fight Jarasandha? He ran away from the battlefield. This is a problem with India. Actually, and it's so interesting because Sri Vishwanath explains that the Lord performs these deals exactly to maintain the faith of the atheists. Because Krishna has to maintain everyone's faith. He has to maintain the atheists as well as the theists. So, in fact, the final pastime of Krishna's Earthly leaders, when he disappears, he's sitting under a tree. I don't want to go into it in detail, but you know, there's a final passage when Krishna leaves the material world and goes back to the spiritual world, and there's a certain way in which he disappears. And many atheist people in India think, wow, look at what an ordinary person, how he, you know, I don't want to use the word for Krishna, but you know, how an ordinary person, how he just left, you know. The word they use is died, but I don't want to use that for Krishna, it just doesn't feel right. So anyway, so atheistic people think like this in India, that how can you worship this Krishna who ran away from the battlefield and couldn't even face Jarasandha in battle? You know, what kind of weakling was he? And a diplomat, they call him a diplomat, that, you know, in the battle of Kurukshetra, Arjuna wanted not to fight, Yudhishthira wanted peace, but Krishna incited all kinds of diplomacy to kill Dronacharya, to kill Bhishma Dev, you know, to actually defeat Duryodhana at the very end. So in this way, Krishna maintains the faith of the atheists. He has to. He's the Supreme Lord, he's the shelter of everyone. If he doesn't maintain the faith of the atheists, who will? Right? So Krishna does it. He's so kind that he maintains the theists and the atheists. So carrying on here, it says, he was not at all afraid, but he pretended to be an ordinary human being, frightened by the immense quantity of soldiers and resources of Jarasandha. Without any weapons, Krishna left the battlefield. Although his lotus feet, and this Prabhupada's like, although his lotus feet were as soft as the petals of a lotus flower, he proceeded for a very long distance on foot. So we get a sense of Prabhupada's softness, his feelings for Krishna. That even in this battle, Prabhupada was concerned, you know, his soft lotus feet, how they must have walked for a long distance from the battlefield. How they must have walked, so painful. And then, just read one or two more lines here. Yeah. Due to this pastime, Krishna, this is the next paragraph, I'm reading in the middle of the paragraph. Due to this pastime, Krishna is known as Ranchor, which means one who has left the battlefield. In India, especially in Gujarat, there are many temples of Krishna known as temples of Ranachorji. Ordinarily, if a king leaves the battlefield without fighting, he is called a coward. But when Krishna enacts this pastime, leaving the battlefield without fighting, he is worshipped by the devotees. So a devotee worships that form of Krishna who ran away and a materialist thinks, that's the reason I don't worship him. You know, the devotee thinks, wow, my Lord is so amazing. Although he could have destroyed Jarasandha like this, he chose to run away. A demon always tries to measure the opulence of Krishna, whereas a devotee never tries to measure his strength and opulence, but always surrenders unto him and worships him. By following in the footsteps of pure devotees, we can know that Krishna, the Ranachorji, left the battlefield not because he was afraid, but because he had some other purpose. So the purpose was that he was going to kidnap the daughter of King Bhishmaka, also known as Princess Rukmini. Which leads us to actually the next pastime, where Krishna pretends in order to accomplish some other task. Karnadipu, we're talking about how the verse was saying how Krishna runs away from fear of lions and tigers. He runs away from fear of lions and tigers. He's not afraid, he's pretending to be afraid. So we're just discussing two pastimes from Krishna book where Krishna pretends. First pastime is Jarasandha. Krishna pretends to be afraid, he runs away. Second pastime, now we'll discuss. So the second pastime is when Krishna is one day sitting with his dear wife, King Rukmini, and he wants to see her irritated, actually. And sometimes husbands, I don't have any experience because I'm not a married man, but apparently sometimes husbands like to just tease their wives just to kind of watch them get irritated. Maybe Subhal Prabhu can share something on that later, but just kidding. No, actually it's funny. The other day I was talking to Rasa Mataji and Mohit Prabhu while doing vegetable cut-up, and I said something about how I was explaining to them how Gauranga Prabhu in his lecture was explaining the definition of violence and non-violence. This is so profound. Gauranga Prabhu was saying that actually, what is violence? Violence means to subvert somebody else to your will. That is real violence. So Arjuna didn't want to follow the will of Krishna. He was trying to subvert Krishna to his will. That is real violence. He was pretending to be non-violent, but actually he was extremely violent because he didn't want to do what Krishna wants. So I was just saying, sharing this with Mohit Prabhu and Mother Rasa, that actually a violent person is somebody who wants to subvert others to their will. And Mohit Prabhu was like, yes, my wife is the most violent person, you know, just to tease her like that. So I can see that this rasa exists even in the material world, that husbands like to make fun of their wife. So look at what Krishna says here. This comes from the spiritual world, by the way. So it says here, this is Krishna book, chapter 59, and it's kind of deep into the chapter. You might have a hard time finding it, so 59, this one is 59. Now I'm on a new chapter. Yeah, now I'm on 59. So now we're going to read about Krishna's dialogue with his wife Rukmini that he purposefully created just to see some irritation on her face. So here's how it begins. So basically before Krishna starts speaking to Rukmini, he was thinking that there was at one point in time Narada Muni had come from the heavenly planets and presented Rukmini with a Parijata flower, a very beautiful flower that grows only in the heavenly planets. And because Narada Muni is our transcendental spaceman, he can go everywhere in the universe, he went to heaven and brought this beautiful flower back and gave it to Rukmini. Just like recently, I remember there was an event somewhere and some devotees had come from Florida to Sadhu Sangha and brought these like gardenias, like these really beautiful gardenias growing in Alachua, like fragrant, like anything, you know, and presented it to one sannyasi at Sadhu Sangha. It's like, wow, so opulent. So imagine a flower coming from the heavenly planets. And at that time, Satyabhama got a little bit envious, one of Krishna's other queens, and she said, I also want a Parijata flower. Matter of fact, I want a tree, a Parijata tree. So Krishna went to the heavenly planets and brought a whole tree back for his next queen. And at that instant, Krishna was thinking maybe Rukmini would be a little bit jealous. It's just the nature of, you know, like you have multiple wives, one wife gets more than the other, it's natural to feel a little jealous. So Krishna was thinking Rukmini would be a little jealous, but no, nothing. She was just happy and peaceful and there was no irritation on her face. So Krishna was thinking like this. So then, it says in Krishna book, Rukmini would also demand something, seeing what Satyabhama got. But Rukmini did not mention anything of the incident, however, for she was grave and simply satisfied in her service. Krishna, however, wanted to see her a bit irritated. And therefore, he schemed in order to see the beautiful face of Rukmini in an irritated condition. Although Krishna had more than 16,000 wives, he used to behave with each of them with familial affection. He would create a particular situation between himself and his wife in which the wife would criticize him in the irritation of love, and Krishna would enjoy this. So, Krishna is Akhila Rasa Murti. He wants to experience every single rasa that can be experienced, including the rasa of being chastised out of irritation. In this case, because Krishna could not find any fault with Rukmini, for she was very great and always engaged in his service, he smilingly, in great love, began to speak to Rukmini. Rukmini was the daughter of King Bhishmaka, a powerful king. Thus, Krishna did not address her as Rukmini. He addressed her this time as the princess. So this is the beginning of Krishna's way of trying to irritate Rukmini. He says, my dear princess. Now see, right there, you know, a wife wants to be called by her name. And you call someone, my dear princess. Already Krishna is creating like a distance. Oh, you're a princess, my dear princess. He says, it is very surprising that many great personalities in the royal order wanted to marry you. Although not all of them were kings, all of them possessed the opulences and riches of the kingly order. They were very well behaved, learned, famous among kings, beautiful in their bodily features and personal qualifications, liberal, very powerful in strength and advanced in every respect. They were not unfit in any way, and over and above that, your father and your brother had no objection to such marriages. So what Krishna is referring to is that in previous times, for princess to get married, there would be like an open contest. Okay, so the princess would be there, and all these princes would, the different princes from all over the country would come and vie for the hand of the princess by doing some sort of competition, you know, just like in the case of Arjuna, he had to shoot in an arrow through the eye of a fish while looking at her reflection in the water. And it's complicated, but it was a very difficult task. And that's how he married Draupadi. So in the same way, something like this was organized for Rukmini, and Krishna begins his little plan by speaking about how, oh, there were so many great princes there. Wow, they were all powerful and strong and handsome, right? And your father and brother had no problem with you marrying any of them. On the contrary, they gave their word of honor that you would be married with Shishupal, right? But they had also promised Shishupal, even though so many princesses were there, they had married Shishupal, that you would marry our daughter. The marriage was sanctioned by your parents. Shishupal was a great king and was so lusty and mad after your beauty that if he had married you, I think he would have always remained with you, just like your faithful servant. In comparison to Shishupal with his personal qualities, Krishna says, I am nothing. And you may personally realize it. I am surprised that you rejected the marriage with Shishupal and accepted me, who am inferior in comparison to Shishupal. I think myself completely unfit to be your husband, and because you are so beautiful, sober, grave, and exalted, may I inquire from you the reason that induced you to accept me? Now, of course, I can address you as my beautiful wife, but still I may inform you of my actual position, that I'm inferior to all those princes who wanted to marry you. Now, this is, of course, not something very nice for Rukmini to hear. She knows the glories of her husband, that he's so amazing, so wonderful. He's Krishna, you know. So Krishna is purposefully putting himself on a lower pedestal just to make his wife a little bit annoyed and irritated. Because actually, later on, he says many more things to kind of unnerve her. It's a very beautiful pastime. If you're interested, you can go read it. It's in the 59th chapter of the 10th canto. But it's 8:25. I like to stop usually about now, so that if people have any questions or corrections or comments, we can take them now, and that way class will end by 8:30. Josh Babu?
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
I was thinking about this point that you brought up about how when we come to Krishna consciousness, we may find a solution to our distress, and then we may forget why we came to begin. And I was thinking about my own life and how very early on in Krishna consciousness, I thought, oh yes, I came here because I'm inquisitive. But actually, after reflecting and looking back, I can see that I very much came because I was in distress. You know, I find it interesting that sometimes one can occlude the idea of seeking for the fact that actually one is running away from an existential crisis.
Yeah.
And we see this more and more in the world now, that people just, they're not satisfied with the way life is, and it's actually quite, their life is full of distress.
Yeah.
But then that becomes the impetus for seeking spirituality.
Right.
And I saw in my own life, or looking back, I can see that the proof of this was that when I came to a more stable point, actually, there was a period where my desire to progress spiritually reduced quite significantly, because that stress which was driving me wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And so that came to mind when you brought up this point. And I was wondering, what are some ways that one overcomes this, that one gets through it? What are the methodologies that one can do to guard oneself from this, you know, because it's such a thing. We don't see so many people in first world countries that come to religious practice because they're looking for wealth. Like in the third world, it's like you join a temple because there's three meals a day, you know,
place to sleep.
But we see lots of artis, and then, you know, like a lot of people who are searching for a relief from distress. And then we can see that many devotees, that's a very difficult hump to get over. It's like, my life is good now, everything's okay, and then this kind of slumber is there, this spiritual slumber.
Spiritual slumber, that's a nice phrase. Yeah, we should copyright that. Did you propose understand his question? Alex? In a nutshell, what he's saying is that we came to Krishna consciousness because we were suffering. Then when you start living a Krishna conscious lifestyle, because more or less our life becomes quite sattvic and pure, and therefore the causes of suffering go away. We're waking up early, we're meditating on God, we're doing service, we're associating with nice people, so our suffering goes away. So then that which was driving us to be spiritual is no longer there, and therefore we enter into a sort of spiritual slumber where we just kind of keep the show going, you know? We read every day, we chant every day, we do our service, we tell people we're devotees of Krishna, but that eagerness, that inner burning desire to want to really cross over and really find God is sort of gone, right? And you're young, but I know what he's talking about, because that point usually comes after a few years of practice, maybe like 6-7 years, then you start to think like, oh, where's that burning fire? And I have one thought, because I've thought a lot about this myself, for my own self, how to get out of my state of spiritual slumber. And I can only share two things from my own experience. The first is taking stock. So, like, for example, today after I finished chanting my rounds, the thought just crossed my mind, how was my japa? Was I actually meditating on the Lord? What was I actually thinking about? It just happened randomly, and I took stock of my japa, and I realized it was not that great. You know, I mean, I was awake, and I chanted a lot of rounds, but in terms of contemplation, in terms of quality, in terms of the heart, I wouldn't say much went in, you know? So I took stock, and taking stock gave me a little impetus. Okay, Harisham, tomorrow, try harder, you know? Try a little bit harder. So I think taking stock is a really healthy practice. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the same thing. He says, every Ekadashi, one must contemplate, what are the things I've overcome? What anarthas have gone, and what new anarthas do I see cropping up in my heart? Where can I make improvement in my practice, you know? How's the quality of my chanting? How's the quality of my Vaishnav Sangha? Am I able to sit in here with absorption? So I think if anybody just takes stock, then he'll realize I'm in a state of spiritual slumber, that actually I don't have great relish for the activities of devotional service. And the second thing I would say, at least in my experience, which really worked, is allowing yourself, basically putting yourself in spaces where a spiritual experience can manifest. So occasionally going to Vrindavan, you know, occasionally just taking a retreat and going up to Wisconsin, getting an Airbnb, sitting by the lake and chanting like 64 rounds and reading Krishna book for 3 hours. Just occasionally, just giving yourself, or going to a holy place, going to some sacred place, and just creating some openness in your heart and in your life for some spiritual experience to touch you, something that goes beyond the normal level of spiritual experience we have. And I feel like this can be a very, very powerful impetus to get out of spiritual slumber. Because when we taste a drop of something truly transcendental, like for example, for me it was in Kartik. We went to Kanai Natshala and we did that kirtan under the tree. This is the place where Lord Chaitanya had darshan of Gopal on his way back from Gaya. And it's this beautiful place by the banks of the Ganga. ISKCON owns the land, and there's this guest house. Literally right outside the guest house is the Ganga flowing. And there's a tree where Lord Chaitanya had darshan of Gopal. And we sat under that tree, the last Kartik, the last Ekadashi in Kartik, did kirtan, myself, Bhakta Josh, and Acharya Nishtaprabhu. And that for me was a very powerful, I'll never forget that night, you know. It was a very powerful spiritual experience. It allowed me to taste something I don't normally taste. So somehow or other, you know, we were able to get there and, you know, create that opportunity, but then mercy has to flow. And I think if we're lucky, some mercy will flow. A genuine spiritual experience is a powerful way to shake us out of our spiritual slumber. Like, wow, there's a whole lot I haven't yet experienced. You know, I know about these things. It's like Gauranga Prabhu says, you may know how to make 100 ways to cook khichdi, but you haven't made a single bowl yet. You know, you may know how to make a Napolitana pizza, you know, with kaparis, you know, but you haven't even made the dough. So you know, sometimes even in Krishna consciousness, I've read the recipe book many times, but I don't know how to make these things. So, but occasionally you get a little glimpse of what real spiritual life can be like. And I think that's really, you know, it can happen in the association of a saint, it can happen in a holy place, it can happen sometimes just by crying, by sitting in a place and crying to the Lord, like, my dear Lord, I'm such a neophyte, you know, like, when will I have love for you? And then something might happen, Krishna might bless you with a little spiritual spark that we treasure and we hold on to, and then, you know, we remind ourselves like, wow, there's a lot I haven't experienced. I don't know, those are some thoughts, but maybe others want to add something. Subhap Prabhu, Mother Krishna Arjuna, something you want to... I know you're mulling over things, so you must share them also. Okay, no pressure.
Yeah, reflecting on my coming to Krishna consciousness also, in one sense, you know, I'm thinking that this, you know, the Duskritinas, the four, in one sense, many of us are, you know, in that category, and more or less, you know, pursuing materialistic life happily. Having some sense of things, you know, just as is described in the Bhagavad Gita, that religion is irreligion, and that, you know, everything is topsy-turvy. But then by the contact with devotees, then you're made pious, you know, your fortune is created. And then the process of devotional service starts. So, and it's always depending on the mercy of the devotees. And through the mercy of the devotees, then we experience, or at least I can say, I have been experiencing, you know, those moments that you explain. You know, we've been taken through mercifully, given all these opportunities that creates, you know, the Parandrishta Nivartante, this higher taste. And then, you know, that creates gradually more and more desire to go deeper and deeper and deeper. But I can say, reflecting on myself, that it was the mercy of a devotee of Krishna that expertly was able to see whatever propensity I have and take that impetus that I have for sense gratification, for pursuing happiness in the material world, and just, okay, find that that same impetus is what, you know, was put into something, you know, that is for the glorification and the service of Krishna. And that same impetus of finding happiness, you know, through this particular nature that I have, is also being directed, you know, is talked to be directed to advancing Krishna consciousness. Specifically, this I can tell you that, you know, my life dream as a young person was to be a famous performer. And I was trained to be a performer. And I was good in performance, you know, and as a musician. And then there's a very expert devotee that saw that, put me, okay, so you are in the street performing for people, you know. And it fit me like a glove. I was like really happy. But I never experienced that type of happiness that I experienced in Harinam. In comparison to, you know, what I experienced in playing shows, you know, and things like that. So it changed my life. And I still was pursuing the sense, you know, my nature. It was a material, it was in one sense, you know, still, it was a mixed thing, you know, so it's materialistic in one sense. But it was directed towards Krishna, and it was, you know, it works.
Purified.
So, and I think that still applies in one sense, you know, we have certain propensities, and our mixed devotion is being purified by the wonderful process that Krishna has given us, and the acharyas and the devotees are guiding us through. So we're very, very much depending on that. Is there... is Krishna's wonderful an amazing arrangement for the living entities in this material world to advance, and the mercy of the great devotees. That's, you know, some reflection.
Sure. Thank you for that comment. I think we'll end here now. It's already 8:36. So thank you for that nice comment, question.
Srimad Bhagavatam Ki. Yeah, energy.